I appreciate the songs that Mike led, especially that last one. That hymn is an example of one that uses imagery exclusively from the Old Testament, I believe, to describe how Jesus leads us. And that's something that I've discovered, especially as we've rolled around our studies on Wednesday nights, starting in Genesis, and we've now worked our way up to getting close to the conclusion of Judges, is that you can preach an entire lesson from the Old Testament. And it makes sense to us understanding the big picture, being able to fill in the gaps. But if you just focus on the Old Testament and what God has in store for us within the Old Testament passages, there's a lot in there that I think I've overlooked throughout most of my life. And so I've taken the stand, many of the lessons that I've written and delivered in the past year or so have been exclusively from the Old Testament, and so it will be for tonight. I was intrigued while teaching Joshua and now studying through Judges about this city Shechem, which has cropped up a couple of times, and I know we've mentioned it in class. I mentioned it to the high schoolers when I was teaching, but I didn't quite understand exactly all that was involved there. And so I want to dig a little deeper into this city and the lessons that we can learn. I know Ryan has touched on it a little bit, but I want to dig deeper and get a more fuller picture specifically of Shechem. Now, the picture I have up here on the screen is of the modern day city Nablus, which is the site of the Old Testament city Shechem in Israel. The picture is taken looking out toward the west, and you see two mountains there. On your left-hand side is Mount Gerizim, and the right-hand side is Mount Ebal. Remember these mountains. We're going to be visiting them later. But the city of Shechem is located here kind of in the valley in between these two mountains. And so I want to take a look at six instances in the Old Testament where we see stories of God's people in the city of Shechem. And this may not make sense at first, but I just want to go through these stories at first, get our base level, and then we'll bring the conclusion as to why this is all important. So the first one I want to start off, the first mention of Shechem is when Abram visits Shechem. In Genesis chapter 12. And there we see a familiar passage with the promises that God gives to Abram. And starting verse 1 of chapter 12, it says, "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Get out of your country and from your family and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. And I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed.' Then Abram departed as the Lord had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed from Haran. Then Abram took Sarai, his wife, and Lot, his brother's son, and all their possessions that they had gathered, and the people whom they had acquired in Haran. And they departed to go to the land of Canaan. So they came to the land of Canaan. Abram passed through the land to the place of Shechem, as far as the terebinth tree of Morah. And the Canaanites were then in the land. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, 'To your descendants I will give this land.' And there he built an altar to the Lord who had appeared to him." So as Abram takes his journey of faith, following God's command to the land of Canaan, the first place that he comes to is Shechem. And it's here that God renews the promise that he made to Abram, telling him, "To your descendants I will give this land, the land on which you are standing now." And he builds an altar in this city, sealing the covenant that he makes with God. If you'll also notice that he comes to the terebinth tree of Morah. Keep that in mind. We're going to see that occurring as well. But that's where this is taking place, near that terebinth tree here in Shechem. So then we skip ahead a couple generations to Jacob in Genesis chapter 33. Now, when we studied through Genesis, we talked a lot about Jacob and about the journey that he went through spiritually throughout his life. He has stolen the blessing from his brother. He has had his troubles with Laban. He has been on the run from his brother Esau. He came back to meet him here earlier in chapter 33. And he also met him there in chapter 32. He had just recently wrestled with God. He's gone through a lot of life-changing experiences throughout his life. And finally, as we get to the end of chapter 33, we see Jacob making a trip to Shechem. And starting verse 18 of chapter 33, it says, "Then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the part of Canaan, when he had come from Paddan Aram. And he pitched his tent before the city. And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected an altar there and called it El Elohe Israel." So a couple of significant things happen for Jacob here. One is that he buys a piece of land. That's showing literally an ownership of the land that God had promised to him. He wanted to take ownership of all the wanderings that he had done. He'd been a nomad for most of his adult life. And now he's buying a parcel of land and pitching his tent there. Some permanency to that action. Like his grandfather Abraham, he erects an altar here to God. And he calls it El Elohe Israel, which means God, the God of Israel. After all the wanderings that he's done, he's finally come to that spiritual point in which he can make God his God. Not his father's God, but his God. And thus, we see a dedication of himself, of a covenant in with him and the Lord. As we continue the... Before I go on, I did want to go to chapter 35 as well. We'll come back to chapter 34 in a minute. But in chapter 35, we have Jacob leaving Shechem. So here's, we just read about when he came to Shechem. Now we're going to talk about as he's leaving Shechem, he's going to return to Bethel, where he had been before. And at the start of chapter 35, it says, "Then God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there and make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother. And Jacob said to his household and all who were with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments. Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone." So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and the earrings which were on their ears, and Jacob hid them underneath the terebinth tree which was by Shechem. Notice the phrase, put away the foreign gods that are among you. We're going to see that later on as well in our journey tonight. And so those who are with him, his servants, his household, perhaps even his sons, participating in some of these worship of foreign gods, they had not made his God their God. But he takes that all away, buries it at Shechem. Shechem is a place where he decides, my family is not participating in these foreign gods. And again, we see the terebinth tree, which is by Shechem, in which he buries these foreign gods to be remembered no more. All right, so now let's move on to the next generation. We've got Joseph. Well, I don't want to focus on Joseph actually being in Shechem. I more want to focus on Joseph desiring to be in Shechem. Remember, Joseph is the one who goes to Egypt first, and the rest of the family is going to follow in the day of the famine, or in the years of the famine, in which Joseph was placed there to save the family. But as he's dying there in Egypt, he makes an extraordinary wish. In chapter 50 of Genesis, verses 24 and 25, Joseph said to his brethren, "I am dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Then Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, "God will surely visit you, and you shall carry my bones from here." Though Joseph was going to die in Egypt, it was his dying wish that he not remain in Egypt. Instead, he wanted to go back to the land that was promised to them, the land in which he belonged. And in Joshua chapter 24 and verse 32, we see the fulfillment of that. It says there, "The bones of Joseph, which the children of Israel had brought up out of the land of Egypt, they buried at Shechem in the plot of ground which Jacob had bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, for 100 pieces of silver, and which had become an inheritance to the children of Joseph." So this land, the land of Shechem, would mentions belongs to the inheritance of Joseph, probably rightfully so because of the claim that Joseph makes here to desire to return to that land. And so Manasseh would be the one that would inherit Shechem. But at that very plot of ground that Jacob had bought earlier, had staked his claim that this was going to be my home, Joseph connects himself to that same claim, the same promise from God to make that his home. Now let's go back to Genesis chapter 34. Here we have, the heading in my Bible calls it the Dinah incident. And while most people may think of it that way, the story's not about Dinah, I don't believe. If you remember the story, I'm not going to take the time to read it, but while Jacob is residing here in Shechem, we have an encounter with Shechem, who's the son of Hamor, who Jacob had bought the land from. So we have Shechem the man and Shechem the city, both in the same place right here, who violates Dinah, angers the sons of Jacob, particularly Simeon and Levi. And we see them taking revenge then on Shechem. And it's not that they take their revenge on Shechem, but I like to focus on the manner in which they took their revenge on Shechem. They deceived him into being circumcised. The circumcision was an act of the covenant that God had made with Abraham, that he would be part of the people of God. And here Shechem, perhaps very legitimately, wants to be part of the family, wants to be part of the blessings that they have as a family. But instead, Simeon and Levi use that covenant of blessing of being a part of this family to do evil to Shechem and to put him to death. And Jacob makes lament about this. And there at the end of chapter 34, but I want to go to Genesis chapter 49. Whereas we get to the end of the life of Jacob, Jacob is still remembering this incident in which Simeon and Levi had destroyed their neighbors while they dwelt there in Shechem. And in verses 5 through 7, as he's giving his last words to his children, giving some prophecy in here, he says, "Simeon and Levi are brothers, instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man. In their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." Jacob doesn't have anything nice to say about Simeon and Levi. He points to this one act of cruelty and violence, and they bear the curse of that act. Notice the last lines, "I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel." my understanding that this is fulfilled in that Simeon would be divided in Jacob, in that his land was completely consumed by Judah. So much so that it almost became like he didn't really get his own inheritance. Because you remember the divided kingdom, we have the split between 10 tribes and 2 tribes. Well, the 2 tribes would be Benjamin, Judah, and Simeon. But Simeon kind of got lost in the mix. And perhaps you kind of lose that special inheritance that he had. They don't think of themselves as an independent tribe. Maybe perhaps how he gets divided within Jacob. And then Levi is scattered among Israel. He doesn't have a land of inheritance, a belonging, centralized location like the rest of his brothers. But instead there are 48 cities given to Levi that are scattered throughout the entire land of the inheritance. And so we see curses being given to Simeon and Levi for their actions in Shechem. Then let's move forward to Abimelech, who we just studied recently. In Judges chapters 8 and 9, we get some information about Abimelech. And I want to start reading in chapter 1 of verse 9. I'm sorry, verse 1 of chapter 9. Then Abimelech, the son of Jerubbaal, went to Shechem, to his mother's brothers, and spoke with them, and with all the family of the house of his mother's father, saying, "Please, speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem. Which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbaal rule over you, or that one reign over you? Remember that I am your own flesh and bone." And his mother's brothers spoke all these words concerning him in the hearing of all the men of Shechem, and their heart was inclined to follow Abimelech, for they said, "He is our brother." So they gave him 70 shekels of silver from the temple of Baal Berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless men, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left because he hid himself. And all the men of Shechem gathered together, all of Beth Millo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree of the pillar that was in Shechem. Now, if you remember, Abimelech here is the son of Jerubbaal, which is Gideon. Gideon had spent his lifetime defeating the enemies of Israel and was greatly honored because of it. And we talked a little bit about him, but I don't want to focus too much on him. The next generation of his sons, though, did not hold up to the same honor that he did. Abimelech, who was born in Shechem, one of the 70 sons of Gideon, decides to kill all of his brothers so that he can be king. Forgetting the words of his father Gideon, who in chapter 8, verse 22 when men of Israel wanted him to rule over them, he said in verse 23 of chapter 8, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." Abimelech disregards the Lord ruling over Israel, decides he wants that for himself, and essentially declares himself king in Shechem by the terebinth tree, the same place that Abraham had made his declaration that he was going to let the Lord reign over him. But he's not the only one who declared himself king in Shechem. In fact, if we skip ahead to 1 Kings chapter 12, we see after the kings have been established in Israel, after Solomon has reigned, who had followed David and Saul, we see now that Solomon's son Rehoboam is stepping in to take over the throne. And in verse 1 of chapter 12, we see Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. And Rehoboam seemingly would have a right to the throne, right? With his father Solomon being the king. But you know, the story that follows is of him asking his peers and the elders for advice on how he should rule the kingdom. And he chooses the advice of his peers to chasten the people, make their lives difficult. And it's no wonder that his kingdom does not do well. But also, we have Jeroboam going to Shechem to set up his kingdom. In verse 25, we see Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. And so it seems like it's kind of odd that you see in this divided kingdom stage that both sides go to Shechem to set up their kingdom. Rehoboam obviously doesn't get Shechem because he's going to return down to Judah to rule. But Jeroboam's rule starts here in Shechem. He builds, he establishes himself in Shechem, and then from there decides to build a couple of golden calves to prevent the people from going to worshiping the Lord and instead trying to subject them to his own reign. And he certainly succeeds in doing that, starting the demise of the kingdom of Israel from the very beginning. So what are we to learn from this? Well, I think it's because of the role that God wanted Shechem to play when they conquered the land. If we go to Deuteronomy chapter 11, Moses told the Israelites that they were going to need to go to Shechem when they entered the land. Although he didn't get to go himself, he laid out some instructions for what they should do when they got to Shechem. In Deuteronomy chapter 11, starting verse 26, he says, "Behold, I set before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and the curse, if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way which I command you today to go after other gods which you have not known. Now it shall be, when the Lord your God has brought you into the land which you go to possess, that you shall put the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. Are they not on the other side of the Jordan, toward the setting of the sun, in the land of the Canaanites who dwell in the plain opposite Gilgal, beside the terebinth trees and Morah?" So Moses directs them to Mount Gerizim and to Mount Ebal to proclaim, to put the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. And we see in the ventures of our of the men that we've taken a look at so far, we have some people going to Shechem, going to Mount Gerizim, to the blessings that are on Mount Gerizim. It should be Abram, Jacob, and Joseph. And others have gone to Shechem, and they've gone to Mount Ebal instead. And the curses that were put on it, being Simeon and Levi, Abimelech, Rehoboam, and Jeroboam. The actual process, so he says it a little vaguely there. He goes into more detail in chapter 27 of Deuteronomy. But I want to turn over to Joshua chapter 8, which is the first passage that caught my eye with this. As we see Joshua fulfilling the words, the commandment that Moses had given to him, and putting these blessings and cursings on the mountain. And so in Joshua chapter 8, starting verse 30, it says, "Now Joshua built an altar to the Lord God of Israel in Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the children of Israel, as is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of whole stones over which no man has wielded an iron tool. And they offered on it burnt offerings to the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. And there, in the presence of the children of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written. Then all Israel, with their elders and officers and judges, stood on either side of the ark before the priests of the Levites, who bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord, the stranger, as well as he who was born among them. Half of them were in front of Mount Gerizim, and half were in front of Mount Ebal. As Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded before, that they should bless the people of Israel." And afterward, he read all the words of the law, the blessings and the cursings, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded, which Joshua did not read before the assembly of Israel, with the women, the little ones, and the strangers who were living among them. So he makes this altar out of whole stones. And again, this is not the first altar that has been made here in Shechem before these two mountains. But this altar was made out of whole stones, signifying a purity in the altar. The stones had not been cut. They were left whole the way that God had created them. Then the words of the law, which again came directly from God, were written on the altar. And when you think about writing words of the law on stone, you immediately go back to the Ten Commandments, which God had written on stone. And stone is eternal. It's solid. Unchangeable. This is what they were to remember, what they were to recite. That the blessings and the cursings of the law were something that were solid, unchangeable. They were dependable. And God makes no uncertainty about the blessings and the cursings that come from the law. I won't take the time to read it, but I would encourage you to go back to Deuteronomy chapters 27, 28, and I mean, going on to the end of the book, Moses really goes in to this whole idea of blessings on obedience and curses on disobedience. In chapter 28, verses 1 and 2, he says, "Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God and observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God." But in verse 15 he says, "But it shall come to pass if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you." Notice the similarity between how he words those. He wants them to observe all the commandments carefully or diligently. All the commandments in this careful manner. And if they do them, the blessings will overtake them. If they don't do them, the curses will overtake them. This is an all-consuming action and results, both in following the commands as well as the consequences of following or not following the commands. And so it shouldn't surprise us when we get to the end of Joshua's life in chapter 24. Very well-known passage of Joshua's final address to the people, similarly as Moses is in his final address to the people, sets up this this event that they were going to participate in once they got into the land, of declaring the blessings and the cursings of the law of God. Joshua goes back to the same place in his farewell. Now you remember Joshua was from Ephraim. That's where he had his inheritance. He had a city which he built there in Ephraim, and he dwelt there. So you would think that this farewell address would have come from Ephraim. But in chapter 24, it says, "Then Joshua," chapter 24 of Joshua, it says, "Then Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel to Shechem and called for the elders of Israel, for their heads, for their judges, and for their officers, and they presented themselves before God." Joshua wasn't content to be in his own place and call everybody to him. He instead went to Shechem, called everybody to Shechem, where he could get them in the presence of God. And I'm going to read the message that he says here, because I think it's important for us to see it. Joshua is going to deliver this message, but before I read it, I want you to notice that Joshua does not, he's going to talk about the history of Israel, but he's going to talk about it in first person. He's going to talk about it from the perspective of God, giving the words of God himself, which I think is very key. So he says, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, your fathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, the father of Nahor, dwelt on the other side of the river in old times, and they served other gods. Then I took your father Abraham from the other side of the river, led him throughout the land of Canaan, and multiplied his descendants and gave him Isaac. To Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau. To Esau I gave the mountains of Seir to possess. But to Jacob and his children, went down to Egypt. Also I sent Moses and Aaron, and I plagued Egypt according to what I did among them. Afterward I brought you out. Then I brought your fathers out of Egypt, and you came to the sea. And the Egyptians pursued your fathers with chariots and horsemen to the Red Sea. So they cried out to the Lord, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians, brought the sea upon them and covered them. And your eyes saw what I did in Egypt. Then you dwelt in the wilderness a long time. And I brought you into the land of the Amorites, who dwelt on the other side of the Jordan, and they fought with you. But I gave them into your hand, that you might possess their land, and I destroyed them from before you. Then Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, arose to make war against Israel, and sent and called Balaam, the son of Beor, to curse you. But I would not listen to Balaam. Therefore he continued to bless you. So I delivered you out of his hand. Then you went over the Jordan and came to Jericho, and the men of Jericho fought against you, also the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. But I delivered them into your hand. I sent the hornet before you, which drove them out from before you, also the two kings of the Amorites, but not with your sword or with your bow. I have given you the land for which you did not labor, the cities for which you did not build, and you dwell in them. You eat of the vineyards and olive groves, which you did not plant." So the history of Israel is around what God has done. He says, "I have done this. I brought you out. I did this for you." And Joshua has been a witness to all these things since the Exodus from the land of Egypt. And his conclusion then of the whole matter is, he says, "Now therefore, fear the Lord. Serve him in sincerity and in truth, and put away God, put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the Lord. And if it seems evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were on the other side of the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord." Now, I've asked Mike to lead Dare to Stand Like Joshua, conclusion of my lesson. And I did so because the writer got the picture of the same concepts that Joshua is trying to get across. The three verses go through history of Israel coming into the land, and how God has been the rock to bring them in. But the conclusion of the whole matter is a declaration. "But as for me and for my house, we will serve the Lord." How do we do that? The conclusion Joshua makes is that you have to fear the Lord. You must serve him in sincerity and in truth. This is an all-consuming act. Just like the blessings and the cursings of the law were an all-consuming act that the Israelites needed to choose, so also we need to make that choice. Will we take the blessings of the law of God, or will we take the cursings? Sometimes when I think about this, I think about trying to get new converts to serve the Lord, to realize what great blessings there are in the Lord. But that's not who Joshua is talking to. He's talking to arguably one of the most faithful generations in Israel's history. And he's worried about them as he leaves. He's worried that they don't grasp the fullness of what they need to do. Because they say, in verse 16, after he gets done, they say, "Far be it for us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods." They make that mental assent, which, as members of the body of Christ, certainly we have done the same in order to get there. But Joshua said to the people, "You cannot serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your sins, or he will not forgive your transgressions nor your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after he has done you good." But the people said to Joshua, "No, but we will serve the Lord." And we certainly know what the end was for the children of Israel. As soon as Joshua was gone, we have the book of the Judges, which we have painfully made our way through. Certainly not due to Ryan's teaching. It's incumbent upon us to make a choice. Are we going to choose the side of blessing? Or are we going to choose the side of cursing? I urge you today, make that choice. Make it whole. Make it sure. As solid as the stones in which the altars were built and the law was inscribed, that's how your household needs to be. That's the only way that this works. And I've had to live through two broken households before I could finally figure it out. Do it the first time. Be wholly committed. As we sing this song, if you can't be wholly committed, don't sing. Don't deceive yourself. Don't live in between the mountains. You have to choose one mountain or the other and do it with every fiber of your being. I urge you to serve the Lord in sincerity and in truth. Choose this day whom you will serve. Won't you sing with me?